Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello. So if you've been listening to the Slow Newscast for a while now, you might have gotten the idea that we like to do things a bit differently. We don't do breaking news. Instead, we investigate stories that take a bit longer, stories that reveal what's driving the news. And at Tortoise, the newsroom where I work and the newsroom where all the brilliant reporters who you hear on this show week to week work, we also think that slowing down means staying the course and following a story. Has anything changed? Has there been any accountability or a reckoning? And where do we go from here? I'm Basha Cummings, and this week on the Slow Newscast, we've got a special episode called Left to Die, The Next Chapter. We're looking back at one of our investigations to find out what happened next. So we're going back to a really harrowing story that I reported last summer called Left to Die. It was a series in 3 episodes about what happened when a Western energy giant tried to establish itself in a dangerously unstable region in Mozambique where extremists were on the rise. And it was a story of what happened to the people who were left behind as violence erupted. 200 civilians who were left under siege by an armed militia. But it was about so much more than that too. It was about colonial capitalism and corporate responsibility, and about what happens when a $20 billion gamble goes really badly wrong. Here's a taste of how the investigation unfolded.
One of our guys, a local guy from Pemba, got a phone call from his uncle, who's in the military. He came running into the camp and said, "Guys, they're attacking Palma."
At around 3 o'clock, it happened. Al-Shabaab attacked Palma. They shut off the main routes in and out of the area, and they shot indiscriminately. The town was in panic. Both Wes and Nick, in charge of around 65 people between them, suddenly had to move and move quick.
And we just drove as quick as we could. There was people running from the west into town, and there was people running through town towards the beach. We just got into Amarula, and the shooting started around the hotel.
Everyone is lying on their stomachs on the floor of the hotel bar, this straw roof above them. Every so often, you can hear the sound of mortar shells landing, and you can see the people in the video flinching.
That's when a hell of a lot of shooting started. Thousands of gunshots.
By Thursday, the numbers inside the hotel had grown to over 200. Wes and Nick were awake in the early hours at around 4 or 5 a.m., and they were struggling to sleep. But they figured the military would be there soon. And this is really where each step of this story just seems to get worse and worse. Because what they didn't know, or at least they didn't fully understand at that time, was that the militants were busy blocking the roads. Better armed and organized than the army itself, they had made the chance of any land rescue much too dangerous. So to get out, they were going to need choppers. Helicopters began to land on the helipad just behind the hotel, lifting people out.
But during the course of the day, there were a couple of choppers that were able to lift people out. I mean, the first chopper took the administrator and his family. He didn't waste any time. Thursday, we were still thinking, you know, someone out there was making a plan and that our rescue was being organized. I mean, that subsequently turned out to be no one was organizing anything.
It's now Friday, the 26th of March, day three.
Yeah, Friday was bad.
So Robbie said to us that, you know, there's this option, but they can only fetch the expats. And we declined on that. So we said, forget it. Then there was no plan at all. It was at that point we realized, you know, we've been abandoned.
It's a hard thing to imagine as somebody who grew up in the West, to imagine that you would just be left to die. But it's an important point to acknowledge here in this story, to confront head on. It's a point about privilege. As a foreign contractor, you'd assume, wouldn't you, that efforts would be made to come and save you, that your employer would organise something or embassies would kick into gear, that there would be levers to pull. It wasn't the same, of course, for the Mozambican civilians, people who lived in the remotest, poorest region of the country, who were used to being forgotten.
We realised we left with one option, and that is to try and break through with a convoy.
And it was the foreign contractors who came up with the convoy idea. They were the ones with the satellite phones, and after all, the cars belonged to them or their companies. They were trying to reach the mercenaries, DAG, the Dike Advisory Group, to see if they could provide air cover if they did decide to drive out. In a video that Wes shared, you can see a mishmash of vehicles, just enough to cram 150 civilians in. No bags, they say to people. They're going to take up too much space.
Taking space for one person.
In total, around 17 vehicles left the Amarula Hotel in a convoy late afternoon on Friday, the 26th of March, just before the sun began to set.
It's going to be the drive of your life, right?
I remember when we pulled out there, that was just, from that moment we pulled out there, it was just terrifying. And, you know, Adrian put his foot down, and we were going as fast as we could without crashing. You know, it's a dirt road. You know, we're going 100 k's an hour down this road, and there's just a lot of dust in front of us from the cars ahead of us.
Wes and Adrian's car had made it through the first ambush. They were heading to a quarry nearby where they thought that they could make a run to the beach and get picked up from there. Adrian had his foot on the accelerator. They were racing to get to safety.
They fired into the car, and the side window smashed. And I just remember Adrian screaming, "I'm hit, I'm hit." And he's saying, "Guys, I can't drive. You need to take over." Everyone's shouting back to him, "Just keep on driving." And he says, "I can't, I'm going.
Wesley jumped out and pulled his brother from the front seat. He started driving himself, with Adrian now sitting behind him.
When we came to a stop at the quarry there, turned off the car, and I just looked back at my brother, and yeah, he was already dead at that time. There was so much blood everywhere. At that stage there, Martin had a satellite phone, and he went into a little opening. And he phoned his company up in Joburg and told them what had happened. And they said to him, just stay there. They're going to try to get hold of Dag to come in and rescue us in the morning.
They spent the night sleeping, exhausted, traumatised in the bush. And on Saturday morning, Wes woke up at 5 a.m. and finally the rescue came. But before he agreed to be taken anywhere, he asked the pilots to make him a promise.
Before I got on the chopper, I made them promise that I'm not getting on the chopper without them coming back to fetch my brother, which the guard did.
Back in the UK, Tori Hickson, Nick's partner, was in the dark about what was happening. All she could do was wait. Nick was in the last car of the convoy to leave the Amarula.
My colleague was driving, I was in the passenger seat, and it all just happened so quickly. You know, suddenly everyone was driving off.
By now, they're separated from the main convoy. Nick's vehicle was hit by an ambush almost immediately.
And the bullets were cracking past us. we decided to get out of the car. So we were in this gully next to the runway, but we had to make it across this runway, 120 meters of open ground. And that's where I think we stood the best chance of getting hit. The bullets were flying so close to us.
Nick, his colleague Niraj Ramlagan, and a Mozambican security guard managed to make it to the other side. They crawled into the undergrowth, surrounded by insurgents who had just fired at them.
We waited till it was dark. You know, the best route seemed for us to head west up into, there was like this long hill.
By now, Nick was half naked. They hadn't eaten anything since Wednesday afternoon, 2 days before. Some of this information was now starting to filter out into the world and to Tori.
We heard quite quickly that not all the cars had made it. We didn't know which cars had. We didn't know who was in which cars. I can't explain to you what that feels like, not to know. You know, just not to know.
But Nick and Niraj, they couldn't just sit and wait. They needed to try to catch the attention of the aircraft overhead.
So we spent most of Saturday trying to get the attention of the choppers and the spotter plane.
Tori, Nick's partner, knew none of this. She got a call from Nick's daughter asking her to fly out to Johannesburg from the UK.
Saturday morning, Jade said to me, "Can you get here?" And I was like, "Yes, I can." And I flew on Saturday night. I didn't know if he was, I didn't know if I was going to a funeral or a reunion.
Out in the bush, Nick and Niraj had made the decision to follow the soldiers, to walk with them back to Afungi where the Total compound was. But to do this, they'd need to walk straight through Palma, or what was left of it.
I heard the spotter plane and I just ran outside. And as I ran out, one of the DAG choppers flew past me. They saw me. And 2-3 minutes later, they were on the ground picking us up. Can't tell you the relief. I mean, it's just incredible.
At the end of the series, we heard about how Wes and Nick escaped the horror in Palma. Wes had made it to safety, but he had experienced the terrible death of his brother Adrian, and Nick had been rescued by a helicopter and reunited with his family. Over the months afterwards, I've stayed in touch with them both. We text each other and send each other updates. And after nearly a year of messages and missed meeting attempts due to COVID and sick dogs, Nick and I finally managed to meet in person a few weeks ago while he was in London. For me, I have to say it was incredibly emotional and I gave him a huge hug, which I'm not sure that he was quite expecting, and we caught up. You're finally here. So tell me, what's the last year been like for you since we spoke?
Very difficult trying to, initially after the attack, come to terms with what had happened. I think psychologically it took a lot of time with close friends and family and with a therapist to just deal with the mental trauma and the fear that came out of the attack. I didn't, you know, as a man and as a guy, you're trying to be the strong one and say that it's you know, brush it off and sort of carry on with your life, but it really isn't that straightforward. Well, it wasn't for me. So fortunately, with some good relationships and, you know, with a trauma counsellor, came out the other side, and from that side of things feel very strong. But the knock-on effects and the financial losses for the business and the mess that all created has been some big issues to deal with.
So tell me about that, because basically during and after the attack, you just had to, everything that you were doing there was just left, and you haven't been able to go back because the situation in that part of Mozambique is still really volatile.
Yeah, so on the day of the attack, we left the gates open and drove out, and for months that's how the property stayed. After the attack, there was a lot of ransacking and theft that took place throughout Parma. It wasn't as bad as we had expected. They shot holes through a lot of things, including our water supply, but they stole all of the generators, the tools, and then, of course, the weather. It's quite a hostile environment for anything metal being on the coast. It's very humid. So all of our materials, at, you know, either baking in a container or sitting out in the sun for the last 18 months.
So what kind of a financial hit are you taking if you just have to abandon all of
so
that?
So there was the total loss of about £1 million worth of stock. That order book that we had for the project, building various camps and site offices for the project, you know, was just eliminated immediately. And with the project not starting again anytime soon, all of that income and that business momentum, you know, was switched off.
And have you had any clear message from Total that they're going to restart or that that business is coming back to the peninsula?
No. We're in fairly regular contact with people, and it just seems that the security situation doesn't allow for that. You know, I can understand the reluctance to go back if there's any risk to people.
And so in that part of northern Mozambique, there are still attacks. It's still dangerous.
Yeah, Parma is still, my understanding is it's still under the control of the Rwandan military, and it is a lot safer than it was. So the people have returned to the village, and I think some of the hotels have reopened, but it's very quiet. Talking to security experts, they'll say, yeah, it's a lot safer than it was, but it's not at the point where they would recommend going and working there, and there's no work to do. But further south from Parma, down towards the town of Mueda and Montepuez and the graphite region, there have been ongoing attacks very recently.
And do you know if the Amarula has reopened?
Yeah, we heard that, well, they have reopened, and that Robbie returned, and what I heard was they had some NGOs staying there, and they'd kind of patched up the hotel.
Gosh. So Robbie, the hotel manager who helped evacuate the dogs, is back.
Yes. You know, he has subsequently said, well, he only decided to leave when he heard that the rest of us were going to form the convoy.
Told
and
me,
leave.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, it was kind of the, from our side, the opposite. His departure is sort of what was the final decision for us to form a convoy and leave.
But now that you're over a year after the attack, has your thinking about what happened in that time changed, or have you got a different lens on it now than you did when we last spoke?
Definitely changes what you think is important. Family, friends, you know, time to do what you want to do, and really enjoying things in the moment, because you do realize just how short, you know, life can be. You know, and for that, I'm very grateful in a way, you know, for the event. The thing is that, you know, life still goes on, and you got to make sure that you don't lose the value of something like that. You know, you wish you could just make a whole new beginning after an event like this. But you do still have the practicalities of life and making a living and fighting with insurance companies and trying to salvage a business, which have got to be done.
Who are you most angry at?
When I think back, you know, I'm still very angry at, you know, at Total in particular, and the Amarula as well. But, you know, my feeling is that Total had the ability to do something about our situation. I understand the challenge of being a corporate and having to operate in a difficult environment like Mozambique, but I would have thought that under the circumstances of March last year that, you know, people's lives contractors and the civilians in Palmer would have come before reputational issues, and it's clear that they didn't. You know, had this happened in, you know, even North Africa or Eastern Europe, it wouldn't have faded away the way it has now. But because it's in a dark corner of Africa, you know, it's these things fade away, and, you know, one wonders if there'll ever be justice for the people who lost their lives.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello.
This is the story of the hardest puzzle in the world.
We are looking for highly intelligent individuals. To find them, we have devised a test.
In January 2012, an anonymous post surfaced online.
It was a series of online cryptology scavenger hunts that turned real life very suddenly.
Nicknamed Cicada 3301, the final puzzle remains unsolved.
But would you call yourself one of the founders of Cicada 3301?
It's a hard thing. Maybe.
Join us as we follow the trail that has gone cold. Archive, the world's hardest puzzle. Available to listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. Safe, efficient, and reliable railways help to keep us all connected, thanks to Network Rail. Yet, maintenance on the railways is a risky and sometimes fatal business. At Network Rail, two previous attempts to invigorate its track worker safety programs had failed, leaving employees feeling sceptical that the organisation could ever get railway safety right. Since 2019, EY teams have worked with Network Rail to deliver a transformation that improved safety protocols and changed employee behaviour around safety. Network Rail RailHub, a new digital safety platform and app, eliminated inaccurate paper trails and worked offline, so it could be used by workers in remote locations. Since the platform was introduced, near misses affecting maintenance workers on the railways have fallen by 40%. Read the full story at ey.com.
For Wes, the last year has been really up and down. After he escaped the terror attack, he returned home to South Africa. And in the weeks and months after, he really struggled with the trauma of what happened with the loss of his brother and with anger. His company, Cube Modular, was struggling financially. All of their kit, which was camps for thousands of workers, which was a huge investment for them, was just left rusting on the edge of the Total Gas compound. And Wes, I mean, he's been trying his best to hold everything together. He moved to be closer to Adrian's wife and children, but things have been difficult. They've gone pretty sour with his company. He's no longer in charge. But to my surprise, he messaged me a few weeks ago on WhatsApp to say that he was back in Mozambique, which is the first time that he's returned there since the attack.
So I arrived back in Pemba today. We managed to get some of our stuff, well, what's left of our assets out of Palmer, which cost us a lot of money. And the whole place just feels like there's a cloud over it. Honestly, it's heartbreaking. It's a lot of the stuff is completely destroyed and stolen and damaged, but it's at least something. So the idea is we at least use what's left over to start again somewhere else.
He told me that it was a really heavy trip for him, obviously bringing back a lot of really traumatic memories of what happened in March last year. He was back at the airport where he saw his brother's body being loaded into the airplane after they were rescued.
I was extremely emotional. It felt like I'd taken a tranquilizer. It just didn't feel real. It was surreal, yeah. When I arrived at the airport, that's where
the first flashbacks came back, you know, just brought back all those bad memories.
And while he was there, there were continued attacks. He was still getting advice on where he could safely go and where he couldn't. So the region is still incredibly volatile.
The insurgents actually attacked a few villages between 40 and 20 kilometers outside of Pemba, which Pemba was always considered the safe area. After they attack cars and people on the road, then they just disappear into the bush like ghosts. Kind of reminds me of what was happening up in Palma. So I don't know what's the future here of the people and stuff, but one thing I do know for sure is that people are suffering. It was not easy, but maybe it's just one of those things that I need to face and can make me stronger at the end of the day.
Neither Nick, Wes, or any of the other victims of the siege of the Amarula Hotel have really recovered from what happened there. But I think where the physical scars have now healed, the financial and the psychological toll is really only just setting in. One thing that really surprised me is that the Amarula Hotel is now open again. The general manager, who came in for a lot of criticism at the time of the attack for escaping with the dogs and leaving many people stuck there, he's back working there. So in some ways, there's this continuity, which feels really surreal. Although Total have not given any clear answer on whether they're going to resume work on the gas project. So one of the things that Nick said to me while we were speaking, which has really piqued my interest and I think feels like the natural place to go next with this story, is he said that there is a graphite mine further inland in northern Mozambique where Tesla has recently announced that it will be purchasing 80% of the graphite that comes out of this mine. Though they've said they won't be purchasing it directly from Mozambique, they're going to go through a third party. The reason that they want this graphite is because it's used in the electric vehicle batteries that they use for their Tesla cars. I think so many of the questions that we asked of Total about responsibility, about what you owe to local people when things go right, but also when they go wrong, about what the Mozambican government is able to promise to people and to companies when they have these incredibly lucrative resources, all of that will come back into play when Tesla starts buying the proceeds of that mine in 2025. So that, I think, is where I'm going to go next. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed going back to revisit one of the stories that we really care about. This episode of the Slow Newscast was produced by Imi Harper. The sound design was by Phil Sansom. The editor was David Taylor. And it was presented by me, Basha Cummings. See you next week. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Slow Newscast. If you like what we do, you like our stories, you like our investigations, and you want to support us and you want to get more of what we do, then you can join us as a member of our newsroom. Just go to tortoisemedia.com/friend and use my code BASHA50. That's BASIA50. Thank you, and I'll see you next
time. Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. Safe, efficient, and reliable railways help to keep us all connected, thanks to Network Rail. Yet, maintenance on the railways is a risky and sometimes fatal business. At Network Rail, two previous attempts to invigorate its track worker safety programs had failed, leaving employees feeling sceptical that the organisation could ever get railway safety right. Since 2019, EY teams have worked with Network Rail to deliver a transformation that improved safety protocols and changed employee behaviour around safety. Network Rail RailHub, a new digital safety platform and app, eliminated inaccurate paper trails and worked offline, so it could be used by workers in remote locations. Since the platform was introduced, near misses affecting maintenance workers on the railways have fallen by 40%. Read the full story at ey.com.
Hi, I'm investigative journalist Nicola Tallant, host of Crime World, a podcast all about criminals, drugs and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe. Join me and my guests for a peek into the world of gangland crime, dirty money and mysterious cold cases. With five brand new episodes per week, and sometimes even more, there's something for every type of crime podcast enthusiast. You can listen to Crime World now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Marc Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Marc.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Next week.